Welcome to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, hosted by Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements of Drab to Fab Landscaping. Garden Talk aims to introduce new ideas to help solve problems and keep you up to date on the latest development in the nursery and landscape industry. For a podcast of today's program and others, visit walteranderson.com and click on the podcast tab. Now, here's your host.
Good morning, San Diego. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I am Ken Anderson, along with George Allman and John Clements. We'll be here for the next hour talking about all kinds of stuff going on in your yard and garden. If you have a question for us, would like to comment on the show, or have a suggestion for a topic or guest you would like to hear about, you can email us at gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com or follow us on the Walter Anderson Nursery main Facebook page. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So far, the summer's turning out to be pretty darn nice here in San Diego, I have to say.
I like summer, and most of the, the May gray and the June gloom has been long behind us now.
Well, and it's not too hot.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's warm, but it's not unbearably hot. Now, that's probably going to change tomorrow, since I just mentioned it. So far, it's been a nice summer.
I recognize I'm an anomaly, because I really like the heat. I'm not good with air conditioning. I'd like to have the windows open. I'm different.
Yeah. My daughter back in North Carolina, my son-in-law, he likes air conditioning. They keep their house at 68 degrees pretty much all year round. We go back and visit them in the spring and summer, and they're all wearing sweatshirts in the house. But on the other hand, in the middle of summer, when it's absolutely miserable in North Carolina, their electric bill is only $160. So,
whoa.
they can afford to keep the house at 68 degrees.
It'd be 3,000 here.
Exactly.
If you have the power to do it.
Right.
Oh, man.
Lots of stuff going on in the garden this time of the year. I have one of the nicest zucchini plants I think I've ever grown going right now. Put one in one of the half oak barrel planters. And one of the keys to it, I think, is it gets consistent water now.
Amazing what can happen in your garden with water.
with some consistent watering. Yeah, it's doing very well. It's just starting to produce. We've harvested one zucchini off of it. But other than that, it's doing very, very well. I'm very pleased with it. And you had a customer that was calling about a tomato issue.
We did, yeah. A gentleman called yesterday, one of our longtime Poway customers, and he was curious if we have seen a tomato collapse of some sort, tomato plant. He said, and it wasn't just him. That's why he was asking. His neighbors, they were bantering about, and several of his neighbors have all been complaining that their tomatoes are not doing well. They're looking poorly, and they're not productive. So I queried the other folks here at the Poway store and had seen it, asked them if they had seen any, an influx of people coming in with similar issues, and no one has. I mean, it's the standard, one or two plants in a large planting of blight, or, John, you mentioned nematodes before, or some tomato hornworms, but not the overall catastrophic failure.
Yeah. If anything, I think my tomatoes are doing better this year than in the past. And like Ken, my zucchinis are wonderful. I don't have any powdery mildew yet.
I don't either.
I'm shocked by.
They look absolutely stunning right now. The only issue I had was it looked like a small slug or a snail had gotten up and chewed a little bit on one of them, but we're just going to cut that off. Wasn't detrimental to the fruit. But I hopefully solved that problem by putting some Sluggo Plus down on top of it. And the other thing that I did when I started planting up the half oak barrels, I've mulched everything that I've put into the barrel.
You've learned from us.
Wow. I'm trying.
Mulch.
Yeah. So, John, you said yet for powdery mildew, right?
Yet.
So is that, it's going to happen?
It most likely will, but.
And what is your go-to repair for that? You just a cut off the leaf
guy?
I cut
the leaves off, basically. Yeah.
That's what I usually do, is cut the older foliage off. I typically haven't sprayed anything for it. And, now with the weather that we have now, probably not going to be a big deal. It's been so warm and dry, and the humidity's been under control. I don't think it's going to be
powdery mildew, though, as you know, doesn't need the moisture in the air. It needs it in the beginning, true. But once it's established, it'll take off, even if it's a nice hot dry summer.
But it hasn't. I haven't noticed any.
That's good.
Any issues? you know, as far as the tomatoes are concerned, I have three big containers of tomatoes. One of them, one of the containers has early girl, and I can't remember what the other one in it, other plant that is in it is, but it is just absolutely solid foliage and a ton of fruit coming on it. Mm. The one next to it is a red pear tomato and another heirloom. They look terrible, but I wow. think, but they're literally 1 foot apart in the same size container, same potting soil, same fertilizer, same water. I think it's just the difference between some of the modern hybrids and the heirlooms. And I just have not seen any heirloom tomato that grows. And maybe it's just my lack of experience, but I have not seen any heirloom tomato that grows as well or with as much vigor as the more modern hybrids. Mm. And production-wise, too.
Yeah, I've had great success, at least in my old house. But I think part of it was they got a little bit more shade for the heirlooms. Here in Poway, I haven't had the same success.
You know, that is a possible variable there because mine are in containers and they're out on the pool deck. They're in full. Right. They're in the most sun that my yard has all day long. So it gets warm. It actually can get hot out there. The modern hybrids love it. I mean, they're just growing like crazy. But the heirlooms, and I've actually got two containers of heirlooms, and both of the containers of heirlooms, the plants are not performing anywhere as well as the modern hybrids are.
Well, you may recall when we had Farmer Roy on when he was talking about tomatoes. He covers his tomatoes with some shade cloth when it starts to get a bit warmer.
Yeah, and he's not that far from me. No. Or from us here.
Right, or from me, right, yeah. Exactly.
He's not that far away. So that might be something to try down the road.
I'm a bit lazy. We keep talking. I think every year we talk about, you know, we should put shade cloth up this year, and there isn't any shade cloth up this year.
Well, certainly for bell peppers, I find you have to have shade cloth.
Really?
Yeah.
They get sunscalded. They get so sunscalded
very easily. Yeah. They really, it's a game changer if you grow those under shade cloth.
Do you know what else they get? They get fertilizer burn when you throw fertilizer on the
foliage. On the foliage.
On the foliage. Yeah. 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 Yeah, I found that out, which I should have known.
You would think, again.
You would think. Yeah.
But, you know, the other thing that strikes me about Farmer Roy, particularly, and what he does with his tomatoes is, do I recall correctly, he was only raising two varieties. It's essentially almost a monocrop of tomatoes where I'm always putting onesies, twosies, you know, I'll have six different ones, seven different ones, and I have mixed success, but.
Well, he's producing for a kitchen,
you know,
and very particular what they're trying to get in there. So, but you're right.
Yeah.
He does do some of the cherries, different varieties in the kind of the kids' garden off to the side.
Yeah. I've typically planted a couple of different varieties and I'm usually every year I'm disappointed in at least one of the varieties that I've tried. I should just for what I'm doing, I should just stick with the ones that I know are going to grow well kudos and not for, be upset about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, well, kudos for branching out, you know, trying other things.
Experimentation.
I have tried. Yeah. So if anybody out there that's listening has had issues, if you want to drop us an email at gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com, we'd be happy to talk about it on the see what else is going on out there. From a company standpoint, no, we have not seen anything I would say that's out of the ordinary.
Correct.
So, as far as what our customers have going on, Rancho Bernardo area, that's a little bit of a puzzle for us right now.
Agreed.
If we hear anything, we will pass it on. Going through some of the news to see what's going on. There's a promising solution for HLB advancing. It's going into phase two field trials following research by a Central University scientist in Ohio.
Hang on a minute. So HLB is Huang Long Bing, right? I mean, it's the citrus greening disease. And how much citrus do they grow in Ohio that it's being researched in Ohio? I'm curious.
That's part of the problem. They don't grow any citrus there, and you can't transport the infected citrus into Ohio, even though they don't grow citrus there. You're just not allowed to transport it. But they found another bacteria that's very similar to what causes HLB, and that's what they've been experimenting with to try to. So if they're thinking if they can treat that, if they can find a treatment for that, then they may cross over to treating the HLB. And it looks like it's working. So yeah, although citrus is not grown in Ohio and infected tissue cannot be transported, they continue to contribute by consulting on experimental planning and data interpretation. So hopefully
that's interesting.
They're going to get somewhere. And in addition to the USDA, Central State University, they collaborated with Citrus Research and Development Foundation and Bayer Crop Science. So there's some big money behind the research that's going into this.
Oh yeah, with any of the big pharmaceuticals and agricultural chemical companies. But I find it interesting that it's being spearheaded more so now out of Ohio versus, you know, San Diego, or not San Diego, but California, Florida, and Texas, for example.
Yeah, it is interesting. And most of the research that I have seen has been coming from Florida. I have not seen a lot of research coming out of California, which really surprises me, especially given the amount of citrus work that they do up at UCR.
Well, we've done three tours to UCR with regard to citrus, I didn't see a lot of research as far as chemicals and that, but they are doing a lot of breeding to breed crops that will be less susceptible to HLB.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I know that has been a big part of it. The unfortunate part about breeding, that takes a long time.
It's not
time.
It's not a tomorrow's solved problem.
Yeah. And none of it's a quick fix. But that's probably the slowest fix that there is, unfortunately.
Correct.
Not only the breeding and checking it out, but then you have to get into production as well. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements. We're going to take a quick break and we're going to be back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with John Clements and George Allman. And we've been talking about all kinds of stuff going on in your yard and garden right now. And today, July 12th, We have classes in both stores.
We do.
In San Diego at 9 a.m., it's going to be Summer Fruit Tree Care with Tyler Trimble. Always a popular class, so if you are planning on going, get there early. So not only can you parking space, but you can get a good seat. So that's going to be at 9 o'clock today in San Diego. And in Poway today at 9:30, it's going to be Vegetable Seed Saving with Adams. And he's going to talk about how you can save your vegetable seeds to replant next year so you don't have to invest in more. And you said one of the things he's going to talk about is seedless watermelon.
He has spoken of that in some of his classes.
Exactly. I'm very curious to see how you save seeds from seedless watermelon.
You don't save them. He teaches you how that happens, how you can get seeds for a seedless watermelon.
We do have seedless watermelon seed. And it's That is very interesting, and I have read a little bit about it, but not nearly enough to discuss it here in detail, with any kind of intelligence. So
when I was at when Capri and I were at Mount Vernon, there's a sign for that attributed to George Washington to his, I guess, head gardener, with regard to seed saving, and he said that you should, and I'm paraphrasing with a lot of liberty here, but he basically said you're a fool if after your first year you're buying seed. You know, he basically, you go out there, you harvest a certain portion of it, put it up so you have seed for future plantings.
Yeah, that is true.
Yeah, and Adams does a really good job of helping you understand, you know, keeping things from getting cross-pollinated, getting the seeds that you want, what plants will give you true to seed, what will not. So it's actually a worthy class if you plan on harvesting and planting your own seeds.
Yeah. You know, I know that was one of the controversies about some of the genetically engineered seed crops that were out there, although I'd have to look at an updated list, but I don't think there's any genetically engineered there's genetically engineered crops out there that are meant straight for human consumption as produce. I know there's a lot of corn, there's a lot of soybeans and things that are used as, I guess, byproducts of production, but not for direct, for direct consumption.
I might disagree with you because there are a lot of products that you purchase now, like cereals, for example. I do gluten-free, and mm-hmm. Cheerios has a lot of gluten-free product. Only their basic one doesn't have anything bioengineered in it, but the rest have bioengineered.
But I'm talking about going and buying an ear of corn
correct.
Tomato.
I see. Okay. Gotcha.
Things that are actually grown for human consumption as produce. Don't think there's anything out there.
There was one tomato that was supposed to be marketed this year.
Okay.
That was going to be GMO.
There was one in the past, but it was such a bad tomato, it didn't last.
It didn't work. Mm-hmm.
It didn't. It didn't work well. There might be an apple, but there's not much.
And you can't get seeds.
No, it's typically not. Right. It's not available to the consumers. But that was one of the things, like with GMO corn, that was highly controversial. Was the corn was engineered to produce one crop, and any seed that was produced, any crop seed that was produced, was sterile. Mm. So farmers could not save it.
Right.
And then prior to that, there was prior to that being engineered into it, as I recall, I had read that farmers that were saving the crop seed could be prosecuted by the hybridizers because it is a patented product. And with patented plants, you cannot reproduce them. So that was an issue at one point in time. I haven't heard too much about it lately, but that was an issue with some of the GMO products out there. So all kinds of interesting things going on in the Wild West of genetic engineering.
We need to bring someone in maybe Brigitte again, or somebody with seeds, on some of the legalities with the seeds that are one time use. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
I don't know if we have any on the shelf.
I don't think we do at all. But I don't know if there are what's out there. But just from an intellectual, not that we can do that part of it.
that's going to be a stretch, George.
Just for the academic side of it, to see what the rules are and where the problems lie. It might be an interesting discussion.
I would agree. I did come across a few interesting articles about honeybees and the continuing saga of honeybees in the United States. And what I know one of the things that we had mentioned before that nobody ever talks about, was as far as honeybees are concerned, is, and they're not native. So they're typically they are kind of an invasive species that we have brought in, and we manage them unless there's and I did see that there was at least one, maybe two instances of feral Africanized honeybees had some problems. I think it was back in Alabama where they discovered a couple of feral, and I don't think they were calling them Africanized. I think they were calling them feral aggressive bees or something like that. But it was basically Africanized honeybees that were causing some problems, but you don't hear that much about it. And it certainly isn't the Armageddon that we were kind of led to believe it was going to be when we were children, of all the other things that we had to be worried about than being worried about being killed by a swarm of honeybees
or quicksand
or quicksand. Yes. That was another one that was, that was high on the list. But it's one of the things that has been still a problem are varroa mites. Mm. And a lot of growers have been trying to work on it. And it says it's not only problematic for the bees, whose entire colonies can be destroyed by an unchecked mite invasion, but also for California, which relies on bees for its food production and economy. And it was interesting, the value of the honey crop in 2024 was about $32.8 million in California, which we produce about 10% of the honey in the United States, which I thought that seemed kind of low to me. Mm-hmm. But then again, I guess honey's probably Technically, I bet honey is something that can be produced in almost all 50 states. I don't know so much about Alaska, and possibly Hawaii, but as strict as Hawaii is with what comes into the state, I'd be very curious. I'd have to look and see if there is a honey market with European honeybees in the state of Hawaii. I don't know.
I don't know that.
So anyway, it says the mites came in from Asia in the 1980s, began infiltrating colonies, and by the early 2000s, they were in everybody's hives, according to the California State Beekeepers Association. Pesticides and other management methods stabilized the bee population over the decades, but commercial honeybee deaths have been soaring in the U.S. in recent years. And the reason why remains unclear. And that's one of the things that's been very interesting is they don't know. There's apparently a lot of variables out there, and they just cannot seem to pin down one particular thing that is happening. They said that between June of 2024 and March of 2025, so a little less than a year, 1.6 million colonies were lost. At an average, about 62% of all the colonies. And that has given rise to more beehive thefts. Never thought about somebody going out and stealing beehives, but
I remember that when I was living in the Central Valley, it would happen sometimes.
I guess
guys would come in with their trucks for like the almond crop, and before they deploy them, you know, they leave them overnight, and sometimes the trucks would be stolen or the trailers, or at least a number of hives.
Just take it. Yeah, that's very interesting. Now this was an interesting thing, and I'm not quite sure how they're interpreting this, but it says besides the mites, honeybees are threatened by pesticides. Okay, I'll give you that one. Mm-hmm. And habitat loss. They're an introduced species. There is no habitat. There is no natural habitat for Africanized honeybees in the state of California.
Maybe even European honeybees, or maybe
the farms that they were depending on are no longer around. But they're still commercialized and moved around.
Right. I thought the term habitat loss was an interesting term. So it says killing the mites with pesticides is complex. The mites have grown resistant to some chemicals. Some beekeepers routinely swap out different pesticides while trying to avoid contaminating the bees' honey with large doses of chemicals. Then that brings in the whole organic issue too, I'm sure. So the financial losses due to mites can be staggering. At a time when you're treating, you want to give the bees a break, but the mites just come back. They blow up, and all the money you spent trying to save and treat the bees is out the door. It's totally disheartening because this is our livelihood. A hive can get you almond pollination money off of other crops, honey. Yeah, so those mites are going to continue to be a problem throughout California and apparently throughout the United States.
So throughout all 50 states, states have honey production of some sort and beekeeping. However, not all of them are commercial. So the states that have the highest production, and interesting, this struck me, North Dakota is often the top producer of honey.
Really?
You would not have guessed that one.
Not at all.
No. North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, California, Florida, Texas, Minnesota, Idaho, Wisconsin, and Washington.
That's very interesting. I wonder if that's just because of large field crops.
I'll tell you what they say typically. It's because they have large agricultural areas, abundant forage, wildflowers, clover, alfalfa, and suitable climates for beekeeping.
Probably a lot of open space too. Yeah.
And then some honey production, Vermont, Connecticut, Delaware, and some of the other smaller states, as much.
Which would make sense given the size.
And too cold for Africanized bees there.
Correct.
That would be nice.
Yes. Yeah.
You're listening to the Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to be back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements. And we've been talking about bees. And George, you had an interesting conversation about your beehive at your place.
Our beehive was destroyed about 2 years ago. Remember when we had Denise on the air, mm-hmm. The president of the San Diego Beekeeping Society. We were chatting with her. We lost our hive. And then we had another hive just recently move in that we weren't aware of. And we went over to check it out. And when we suited up and took, first off, they weren't Africanized, which was nice. They were very docile.
That's always a benefit.
It is. But when we took the covers off, it was covered in wax moths. And if you're a beekeeper or no beekeepers, it's like having cockroaches. They're just everywhere and they're dirty. And it's a sign that you're a lazy beekeeper. Now, we weren't actively doing this hive. There was a feral hive that came in. So yes, we're a little lazy, but they came in and they were making honey. But these wax moths were everywhere. And the larva, when they spin their little web, the cocoons they just get and clog everything up. And then you start to have a hive decline. And so we've got to get in there and clean it up and probably put a whole new rack in it because it's a little bit older. But it does. That's another problem with hives or the wax moths.
Now, when you get to the point where you're going to have to redo that hive, are you going to be able to save the colony that's in there?
I don't know. They looked pretty peaked.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. Sad situation. And John, during the break, you were talking about San Diego's role in honey production.
Yeah.
Back
in the day, 1880s, 1890s, San Diego led honey production in the world. And one of the epicenters was Escondido. There's a huge honey industry there. And then the biggest was in Harbison Canyon. John Harbison had beehives all through Harbison Canyon, and he became a very, very wealthy man through honey.
That's interesting. I'm vaguely familiar with Harbison Canyon. Haven't spent a lot of time out in that area, but was there a lot of agricultural crops in Harbison Canyon at the time?
What the world says, the World Wide Web. Oh. It's black sage and mm-hmm. wild buckwheat
yep.
were the two main crops that they foraged mm-hmm. for their honey production. And to John's point, it was the it was us being San Diego's first major agricultural export.
Mm-hmm.
And honey. In 1875, it led every county in the nation with honey production.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then once John Harbison hit it big, and he's just like a mountain man looking guy, big beard. And
Clements.
Yeah, looks a lot like John Clements, big bearded, hairy guy. But Mr. Harbison, once he hit it big, he left living out in the woods or, you know, out East County, and he had this big, beautiful mansion in downtown San Diego. So he did not linger out in Harbison Canyon once he hit it big.
There probably wasn't a lot out there back then.
No, no.
So that's interesting. I had never really thought about that. Was not aware of that.
Well, sage and buckwheat honey is delicious.
Oh, indeed.
Yeah. It's been a long time, but I remember a long time ago we were somewhere and they had, obviously orange blossom honey was big, but avocado honey.
Oh yeah.
Back when we used to have some pretty major avocado production in San Diego. That's really pretty tragic when you look at it, you drive, especially for somebody that grew up here, mm-hmm. like you and I did mm-hmm. and remember what North County used to look like, before the urban sprawl took over and it just how much of the area was covered with avocado groves mm-hmm. and how much of it is just, it's gone now for a variety of reasons, cost of land for one thing,
cost of water.
I was going to say
cost of water is huge, and cost of labor. Mm-hmm. If you look at some of those places where they used to grow avocados, especially as you're driving up, the grade up into Valley Center, mm-hmm. and some of those groves were on almost sheer mountain walls. And I look at that as like, and those trees are 20 or 30 feet tall. Is how did you harvest that? Mm-hmm. I mean, I couldn't even climb up there mm-hmm. to the base of the tree, more or less get 20 or 30 feet in the air and pick avocados off of it. I just don't understand how they did that. But they obviously did for a long, long time. So, mm-hmm. It's sad. It is sad to see the decline.
It is.
In that part of California's history.
Before you leave the bees, John, you were talking about the history here of bees. They mm-hmm. back in the early, the late 1800s, rather, they actually did the migratory beekeeping too. They would take their hives and do coastal mm-hmm. or inland, depending on the bloom cycle of plants. So mm-hmm. even back in the late 1800s,
yeah,
it was a practice.
That was probably mm-hmm. a much slower practice back then, transporting
on the back of a cart somewhere,
on the back of a horse-drawn cart somewhere. Yeah.
I would have to do that at night. I'd be leery of all those bees bouncing around in the back of a.
Yeah, that probably wouldn't make them very happy.
No.
And you wouldn't want to move the hive in the daytime and leave a bunch of them out foraging with nowhere to go.
I would assume they'd close it off in some manner.
I would think they'd have. I would think if they're going to move it in the daytime, they'd have to screen off the entrances or something right. to keep the bees inside. So that you didn't lose them. Going on a little bit more about bees, commercial beekeepers across the United States earlier this year discovered colonies of honeybees in near or total collapse without explanation in what the apiary industry is calling the worst bee die-off in U.S. history, this has been going on for years now. And it seems like every few years, it's the worst bee die-off in history. And it says these losses combined with honeybee die-off events during other times of the year mean many beekeepers have seen 70 to 100% of their colonies collapse over the last 12 months. But the thing that I find interesting is, and I'm no expert on beekeeping, so.
Nor am I, even though we have a hive.
But the fact that they're suffering these tremendous losses, yet they tell you that without the honeybees, it's going to have severe impacts on the fruit and vegetable production. I'm not seeing the impacts. A 70 to 100%. That's what I would call on the high side. to the point where you would think it would be making an impact. Mm. On crops, but maybe it is making an impact on crops, and I'm just not seeing it in the it would be in price and availability. But
shopping lately?
not seriously, but
joking on that. But we need to bring Denise in.
Yeah, Denise Binyas.
We'll bring her in the not too distant future and talk about this.
Yeah, next month we're going to have her in. But I would just think that when they talk about how critical the bees are, and when you're suffering a 70 to 100% loss, that's a significant loss. I would think that you would start to see effects of that. But I haven't noticed it. I mean, and I haven't heard of any. And in the reading of these articles that I'm pulling this information from, because of the losses in this particular area or things like that, there's a reduction in the almond crop, or there's a reduction in the tomato crop, or I'm not seeing notices of deficiencies in crop productions based on this, but I just find that surprising that there can be 70 to 100% losses, and it's not affecting anything.
Was that article speaking the entirety of the U.S. or particular beekeeping regions?
I think it's over the entire U.S. Yeah, they called it the worst bee die-off in U.S. history.
Okay,
so if you figure 70 to 100% across the United States, that's a big number. So I don't know exactly what's going on here. It does say that this event is reminiscent of the 2007-2008. There again, this is not the first time that we have seen this colony collapse disorder outbreak, when as much as 70% of the commercial honeybee colony was suddenly destroyed. CCD is a is a phenomenon where the majority of worker bees in a honeybee colony mysteriously disappear, leaving behind a queen bee, food stores, and a few nurse bees. And that's the other thing that I think is interesting too, is because they have tried linking this to various pesticides and things like that. Well, if the bees are disappearing, then maybe it may be a function of the pesticides affecting the neurological situation of the bees, where they call it dementia, just fly away and don't ever come back. But usually when you see bee die off, from what I've seen from a pesticide situation, there's a lot of dead bees around.
Right. Right.
So if there's not a lot of dead bees, then there's some other influence acting on it.
What if they're just tired? How many bees how many flowers does a bee go to in a day? It's a significant number.
Oh, we talked about
maybe
that.
Maybe they're just tired of it.
Maybe.
And they're looking for a second career.
There's got to be a better way.
There's got to be something else.
There's got to be a better way out there. So anyway, I think that's very interesting. So we'll make some notes about that, and we'll be sure to bring that up with Denise when she comes in the not too distant
future. Well, yeah, she's teaching a class here in August. We don't have a date yet for her to come on the radio, but we will get her as soon as we can.
Or at the very least, we'll try to get some questions out to her to ask her what's going on, because she's probably the most knowledgeable
person that we know. Yes.
Yeah, that was fascinating talking to her when she was on the show the last time. She had a lot of very good information available. And I'm not going to go into it in great detail, but there are still issues as far as neonicotinoids in bees. And one of the things that they're working on right now is treating seeds with neonicotinoids and how that can be a problem. So it'll be interesting to see how all that plays out. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to be back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements. Next week, be sure to join us. We have a special guest going to be on the show. Karen England from the San Diego Hort Society is going to be here. She's going to be talking about the San Diego Horticultural Society, which has been around for how long now, John?
Golly, probably 35 years.
It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while. We used to meet at Del Mar way back.
Yeah, at the race place.
At the racetrack.
Yeah. Yeah. I know my dad's been involved for maybe since the beginning.
Yeah.
I know he was very involved with it for a long time.
Steve Brigham. Remember,
Buena Creek Gardens. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wonder whatever happened to the gardens. I never got up there to see it. They had a nursery too.
Yes. Yeah, they did.
We used to buy from him.
And specialized in daylilies.
That's right.
Yeah, they had big amount of daylilies there. And Judy Wiggins used to be next door from Judy's Perennials back in the day. She sort of had a little home nursery, had good stuff.
You know, speaking of that particular, close to that area, up in kind of the transition between Vista and San Marcos, off of Twin Oaks Valley Road, there is a road up there called Sarver Lane, and that was Sarver Nursery, and they were known for canna lilies, I think. I met Mrs. Sarver one time way back when she still had the nursery. Well, she was, if I recall, she was about 10 minutes older than dirt when I met her. very, very nice lady.
She knew Adam and Eve.
She may have, but very, very nice lady. And that's what they specialized in was canna lilies. And we used to buy canna lily rhizomes from them way back. Mm. At about the time that I learned to drive. I mean, that's about how long ago it was. But Sarver Lane is still there.
Mm-hmm.
If you take Deer Springs Road and head west, it turns into Twin Oaks Valley. I think it actually where it makes that big left hand curve as you're heading west. I think that's the transition from Deer Springs Road to Twin Oaks Valley Road, mm-hmm. and Sarver Lane is right there. Mm-hmm. If you go north, if you go right there and go north, that's Sarver Lane, and it takes you past the old Sarver Nursery site. And Ampole Nursery used to be there, yeah. Right around the corner on Buena Creek, on Buena Creek. Mm-hmm. And then Buena Creek Gardens was just down the road. Mm-hmm. And then right near that intersection, kind of across the street, there's a little market there on the corner of Buena Creek and Twin Oaks Valley Road. There was a big foliage wholesaler there. It was originally called Dutch Growers. And I think it's still there, but it's not Dutch Growers anymore. I can't remember who it was. But anyway, I digress. I digress, and would you say that
our industry has changed a little bit?
Just a little. Just a little.
Really?
So. But yeah,
it's a shame.
That whole area up there the inland part of it, you know, Vista and around there, with some absolutely fantastic mm-hmm. companies up there. It's where Kent's Bromeliad Nursery is still based. And I think that, well, they were at one time, I think they still are the largest bromeliad grower in the country, maybe even the world. I'll see if mm-hmm. I can get one of the Kent brothers on. Because that's a fascinating story, how that whole business started. And then one of the other nurseries up there that I used to go to every once in a while for just really weird and unusual stuff was Cartus Greenhouses.
Oh gosh, yes, Michael Cartus.
Yeah, and they're still in business.
You know, he died a few years ago, but I think they carried on.
But I believe it is still going on. And then going back again, another nursery that I always loved going to, which is in that same area, and it was on the east side. It was on the east side of 15, just south of Deer Springs Road, was Tropic World Nursery.
Oh yeah,
and then they got bought out by, as have many, many, yes. many people, yep. Moon Valley Nursery. Mm-hmm. But I think Moon Valley has now shut down that operation and has started to consolidate over at their nursery on the west side of 15, which was Plant World.
Yep.
Yeah.
Plant World and Tropic World.
But Tropic World was
they had some great fruit trees, mm-hmm. some unique thing, a lot of, you know, passion fruits and different varieties.
They had some neat stuff there. Yeah. And they had a greenhouse that was, it was just a mess. But if you went through it, you could find some
treasures there.
There was some.
Even though it was a mess.
They did have, now after Moon Valley took over, I stopped there. Disappointingly, because I wanted to go to the other place, and they had some $60,000 Canary Island pines out. I mean, palms out front in big containers. If you guys need one,
well, that's just what you need.
Yeah.
Well, that's expensive food for the palm weevil. Yes.
That's a very expensive palm weevil crop. Yes. Yeah,
going back to Karen England real quick, and then back to your twin. Karen England also does herbs.
Yes,
she does a ton of herb stuff too. So she can, and maybe she can talk about some of the stuff we have here.
Talk about some of the stuff.
And she's going to try to do a class for us in September on herbs.
Yeah, and then there's a couple other places, a little bit farther south there, that I remember. One of them that my dad took me to when I was a little kid, because one of the people that worked for us, who happened to be a very good family friend, was Gerritsen's Nursery. Do you remember Gerritsen's?
I do remember.
It was on Del Dios Highway, mm-hmm. right about the transition between Escondido and Rancho Santa Fe. The property is still there, mm-hmm. and they had a little greenhouse. But Mr. Gerritsen, he specialized in cryptanthus.
Oh my gosh.
And Earth Stars, it's a type of bromeliad. And he specialized in cryptanthus. And we used to go up and get cryptanthus from him back. That was before I could drive. But the property is still there. And I think now they sell garden statuary and fountains mm-hmm. and things like that.
Right.
You see it as you drive.
Mount Israel, I think.
Right there. In that area.
Yeah, right there.
So, but you see that as you're driving along there. And then another one that was actually a pretty famous grower back in the early 70s, and I went there. It was after he had passed away, but Seaborn's Del Dios Nursery.
Oh my God.
And they were a bromeliad grower and hybridizer, and they were on, I want to say, Date Lane mm-hmm. in in Del Dios, in the little community of Del Dios. And I went up there in the, had to have been in the very early 80s. And Mr. Seaborn had passed away, but his wife was still running it. And there again, that was one of those places that you go to. And they had, and I was a huge bromeliad nut at the time. And they had some just unbelievable stuff there. As a matter of fact, the one plant that I do remember that I bought from her the day that I was there was a Neoglaziovia. And it's the only one that I've ever seen for sale. But it's really interesting, unusual bromeliad. You just don't see them.
Wow. You still don't have see them it?
Around. No. I killed it a long time ago.
Okay.
But unfortunately, but it was a really neat, it was a neat place. And he actually published a book on growing bromeliads. It was a paperback book. We used to sell it in the San Diego store back in the late 70s. Very interesting. So yeah, some of the interesting things that used to be in San Diego.
Growers, the plants, I was in the fourth grade and went down to Old Town for the California history trips, that they would do, and you do field trips. And I just remember going to Michael Buckner's Plant Man place.
That's a name I hadn't heard of in a long time.
Bazar del Mundo. And he had the big Platycerium superbum there and bifurcatums. And back when nobody knew what these things were, your dad was into them, a few other people, but just, Dioscorea. I remember I actually pirated my own lunch money because I fell in love with these plants down there, and I saved my lunch money. My dad would give us, I think it was 35 cents a day, use this for your lunch, and I would not eat, and I'd save it. And I went down and bought a Dioscorea.
Michael Buckner,
we should have him on the show.
Is he still around?
Yeah.
Boy, I have not heard that name.
Was California a state in fourth grade when you went to?
It was. Okay. They just discovered gold.
Okay, just checking where we were in history. Right. Yeah.
I know Michael. We should get him on. Ken Conniff would be another great guy to have on the show.
You know who is another one that you don't. And I remember as a little kid, I was always fascinated by it. And I remember playing in the space when I'd go with my dad when we were installing our exhibits at the flower show at the fair. But as you walk in the main gate of the fairgrounds, and the flower show entrance is immediately to the left, just past the restrooms. And you walk in, and as you walked in, on the left-hand side, there was a permanent booth. And it was made out of red brick. And there was a guy that sold Platyceriums there every year. And I think it was Mr. Cass.
Oh, wow.
And Platyceriums are?
Staghorn ferns.
I know. People out there going, what's a Platycerium? Yeah.
And I think it was Mr. Cass,
wow,
who was a very, very well-known staghorn hybridizer from this area. As a matter of fact, we had a longtime customer who used to grow bromeliads and staghorns, and he actually knew and his name was George Shumway, and he lived out.
He
lived out in Point Loma.
Yeah.
And we used to buy bromeliads from him from back in the day. But yeah, I believe that was Mr. Cass that was there. And then another one of the hybridizers was Steve Talmadge.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Platycerium grower here in San Diego for many, many years. All people that my grandfather knew. Speaking of which, a quick mention.
Walk with us down memory lane with John and Ken and the way San Diego used to be.
back at the end of June, we had the pleasure of attending the San Diego Flower and Plant Association annual meeting. And my dad and my grandfather posthumously were honored with a Icon of Industry Award by the San Diego Flower and Plant Association, which was, we were pretty proud to see that. And my dad was at the dinner, got to talk to a lot of people that he hadn't seen in a long time and people that wanted to meet him. We had a good representation from the nursery at the dinner as well. So it was nice to see him get that award. Some of the other people that have gotten the award, Julian Duvall from Boyle Botanical Gardens, now the San Diego Botanical Garden, Paul Leckie Jr., and Paul Leckie III, and Andy Morrow, who was the longtime superintendent of the flower show at the Del Mar Fair for a number of years. So, So we were very happy to see that. And you have
congratulations.
Well, thank you. Yeah. And you have a class coming up.
I do. I love teaching classes. So we're going to
19th.
Yes. The 19th, we're going to talk about aquatic plants, how to do everything from a tub to a pond to all kinds of wonderful ideas and how to landscape that way.
Yeah. John's going to be in the San Diego store at 9 o'clock teaching everything you need to know about aquatic plants. So get there early to get a good parking space and a good seat for that. You've been listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with John Clements and George Allman. We'll be back next week with another hour of Garden Talk when Karen England from the San Diego Hort Society is going to be joining us. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, independent and family-owned since 1928. For more information about plants, products, expert advice, news, classes, podcasts, and more, visit walteranderson.com.